Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freynes at the controls this morning. We're happy to have back once again here on the program Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I. And for a long time, a few times at least throughout the year, he's been good enough to come and sit here in the studio and take questions about dealing with insect pest problems around the home. This can be something inside the house, or it can be something in the home landscape, things that would go after your ornamentals, or maybe you have planted things to eat, any and all of that. If you can call in and tell us what it, give us the best description that you can, and tell us what it's doing, tell us what plant it's going after, then he will see if he can tell you what it is, and then we'll give you some advice on how to deal with it. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So we're here to answer questions, and if we can help you, I'm sure that Phil will do his best. So at any point here, you give us a call. Thanks very much for being here again.
Glad to be here.
Are we now at the point where if you were going to treat for grubs in the lawn, this would be the time?
Yeah, well, we've had enough rainfall that we kind of recommended to people not just go out and preventatively treat, because when we get a lot of rainfall, then the grub eggs are laid throughout the area, and many times that results in not having that many in anyone's place enough to cause damage. But at this time of year is a time when you will start seeing places show up that are brownish and so on. The soil, the turf is going to be easily pulled back, and the grubs will be right there in the root zone. And usually it takes 10 to 12 grubs per square foot to cause injury. If you do see grubs at this time of year, we recommend coming in with triclofenac, which you'll find as Dilox in garden centers and hardware stores. And that will give very quick control. It normally kills the grubs in 3 days, and doesn't last very long. It's gone in 5 days. So if it's a fairly dry situation, it's a good idea to water your lawn before you would apply this, because if the grubs are down several inches deep, Dilox may not reach them, and you may not get any control with something that lasts only a short time like that. Mm. But generally, we don't expect to have a lot of grub damage at this year because of the timely rainfalls that we had, but there will be certainly occasional spots here and there, and many times by checking in various parts of the yard, you can determine that it's just this area, and that's the only area you need to treat. It's they're either there or they're not this time of year.
Yeah. So that was actually something I was wondering about, and I couldn't remember whether it was good if it was wet or if it was good that it was dry. And we've had both. June, July were quite wet, and then August was quite dry.
Right.
So, and I wasn't really sure which way that was going to affect things.
Yeah, what happens is in a dry situation, the beetles will be attracted to damp soils to lay their eggs, and so in a typical year where we tend to have some dry weather in the latter part of June and through July, unwatered turf will tend to go dormant or brownish looking. It's not dead, but it's just gone dormant. And the beetles will fly to the irrigated turf because it's nice and green and it's got soft soil to dig down to lay their eggs. And so typically those lawns are going to end up having the problem. This year should have been a case of where most of the time during the first half of July, we had fairly good rainfall amounts and fairly good moisture levels. And so I'm not expecting large areas of grubs, but there will be spots where for some reason they laid more eggs that are attracted to lights at night and things of this nature. And something that only a grub could figure out will be more attractive to some one person's lawn than another. So, and it may just be, you know, a quarter of a backyard that has a problem or something like that.
And what is it that's the adult form?
The adult is a June bug.
It's the June bug. Okay.
Or that's a Japanese beetle. There are two main groups, three main species of grubs. Two of them will look like June bugs, which are tan and about a half an inch long and heavy-bodied. And then the Japanese beetle, which most people are familiar with, being 3/8 to a half an inch, metallic green with coppery wing covers. The larval stage of all three of these species are white grubs that will feed on turf.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll get right in, and we'll start with someone in Urbana on line one.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about termites and one about carpenter ants. And a little while ago, I was taking down storm windows and cleaning windows, and on one of the windowsills, I saw this sort of dent in the wood, so I poked away at it with my putty knife, And there was a big hole in there about, I don't know, 5 or 6 inches long and at least an inch deep. And so then I had termite people come and do an inspection, and that person said, well, it wasn't termites, it was carpenter ants. Well, I do have some carpenter ants I discovered around the band joist in the basement.
Okay.
In the west side. But there's lots of sawdust where there's carpenter ants. Like sawdust. And mm-hmm. there was no sawdust in this hole. It was just, and it wasn't rotten. In this hole, the wood wasn't rotten.
Okay.
It was the couple pieces broke out. But it was all really hard and not sawdusty and not rotten. So, how do I know whether that was an ant destruction or termite destruction?
Termite damage will tend to be along the grain of a wood in elongated areas that will be eaten out.
Yeah.
It will not cross across the growth rings in the wood typically. The termites will feed on the sapwood, the area in between the rings on a tree and correspondingly in the wood, because the rings of a tree have more anti-termite feeding materials in it. So they will feed that way. So many times what you'll end up getting is elongate areas and there'll be little fine areas, paper-thin pieces of wood that will not be eaten in between, and that corresponds to the rings of a tree. They will also haul in mud to keep the humidity up in that area, and so there will be dried areas of soil associated with the tunnels as well. There won't be any sawdust in them. Carpenter ants do not leave sawdust either.
Do. I've seen it in the basement.
They don't leave sawdust in their tunnels.
Oh.
I'm sorry, I didn't mention. Wasn't that specific? They will kick the sawdust out and
hanging down.
But of course, in a place situation like you described, there's a possibility that any sawdust was knocked outside where it was washed away or knocked down into a wall void or something like that.
I doubt that because it was down in and it was a long hole with the grain of the wood.
Okay, well, you know, there are. It's possible it could be even something else, but generally. If there's no sawdust in the wood in the tunnels, it's most apt to be carpenter ants or termites. And termites, there'll be mud in the tunnels too, and you would have noticed that, I think.
I couldn't see any mud.
Yeah. If the tunnels look pretty clean and open, I would guess that that was probably carpenter ant.
Yeah.
And it may be.
Would they have dug a hole like 5 or 6 inches long and an inch or more wide and deep?
It could be what you're describing. Also, now that you're talking about it, if it was a relatively straight tunnel, this could be carpenter bee damage as well.
Carpenter bee damage?
Uh-huh.
What's a carpenter bee?
A carpenter bee looks a lot like a bumblebee, only it has an all-black abdomen. There are species that are about a half an inch long and others that are 3/4 to 1 inch long. And they will make holes that usually go along the grain of a wood, and will be elongate. Typically, can be a half an inch in diameter or a quarter of an inch in diameter holes. And these are you may have been finding an abandoned one of their areas. They will normally go into wood that's not painted, or the paint is flaked off in an area. Okay, so that may be what the deal was, and if there was no indication of anything in it, it's probably just an old one that's been abandoned. May have been there for decades. It's hard to say.
So I guess your first choice is a carpenter bee. Second choice is carpenter ant. Probably not termites.
Probably not termites. That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you for your help.
You're welcome.
Right. I'll go ahead to talk with somebody else here. This is line number 2, and the caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to continue the carpenter bee discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard earlier on one of the earlier programs, once they drill their hole and lay their eggs, you shouldn't block the hole.
That's correct.
Can you tell me, we stripped the clapboard on our house, and in that time they drilled a hole in the clapboard, and I'm wanting to paint and seal it up. When is it safe to seal it up? When have the eggs hatched and they've gone?
It's probably okay by now, but I would probably, to be on the safe side, wait until we get into cooler temperatures in the wintertime. And it may be a case in this situation where you may be end up painting around those areas or painting the wood anyway, but leaving those holes open, and then sometime during the winter when you get a nice day or an early spring, caulk those holes and then touch it up when you get warmer weather next spring.
All right. Well, I noticed that there is some there's splattering under the hole now, as if something.
Yeah, I would anticipate that they would come out in the second half of August, but it's possible that some could still come out in September. And of course, the reason why you don't caulk the holes is that they're not called carpenter bees for no good reason. They're able to chew through solid wood. And if you caulk the hole, then there's a series of cells along the wood in their tunnel that they've got, and each one will make its own hole come out. So you'll end up with a series of holes in a row instead of one original hole that the young ones that come out will all use if it's open.
Right. Well, does the hole turn or?
It'll go in at a right angle to the board and then make a right angle and go lengthwise with a grain of a board.
How long?
Sometimes 2 to 3 feet.
Wow.
Wow, that's right. So, you can understand now that somebody who decides that they're going to kill the bee by caulking a hole in a bee that chews through solid wood can get a series of holes. I've had calls before that says, I did that, and now I've got like 8 or 9 holes all in a row right back through there. Okay. Yeah. But usually we're not going to attack painted surfaces, so it's not 100% of protection. But get that surface painted. They're not going to come out and start moving around and looking for places to start new colonies next year until about May.
Okay, and once I paint it, the ones that were hatched there won't bore through the painted surface?
Normally not. That's not, like I said, sometimes they do, but most of the time they do not.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And will, if you just left it, uh-huh. would in future other carpenter bees come back to that same spot?
Very likely to, or they may, some other bee might take advantage of it too. We have a lot of leafcutter bees that are looking for holes in wood to make their nests in it. So they will take advantage of a hole that's abandoned sometimes. So you may not get the same type of bee, but you're likely to get another one.
All right. So it is a good idea once you're pretty much sure that they're out of there,
right,
to then go ahead and caulk up the hole.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, wood that's been painted or treated wood is also supposed to be not as appealing. Although
right,
I know
exactly.
I have seen it happen.
Yeah, well, what happens, of course, with treated wood or even wood that's generally considered to have insect resistance, such as redwood or cedar, over time, particularly the cedar and redwood, the materials in there that are anti-insect feedings are going to wash out. And so if it's in a deck or something that's not been protected with water sealer and so on over the years, after a span of 10 years or so, it will leach out enough materials that it will get attacked. So that's a feature of it. And on a treated wood, particularly if it's something that's got a fairly good thickness to it, say a 4x4 or 6x6, there'll be a center area that doesn't get the treatment in it. And if it's been cut off and that treated area is exposed, they'll get into it. Or if the wood is not maintained and you get some pretty deep cracks, sometimes the bees will go in through those cracks and get into the untreated part of the wood.
Yeah. Phil Nixon is our guest. He's an extension entomologist at University of Illinois. And every once in a while he's here. We talk about dealing with insect pest problems around the home. And if you got a problem, give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up, someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Carpenter bees burrow is that long. When you caulk it up, is it necessary to, or at least desirable, to force the caulk into the burrow?
I think in the first place, your chances of being able to caulk the entire burrow are zero to none.
Not as much.
Yeah, and no, it's not really necessary. Generally, what you have is you'd be looking at a situation where if there was a lot of a lot of tunneling, and there might be enough tunneling to structurally weaken the wood, then you would replace the board rather than try to fill it. I think the chances of being able to fill a long hole that long is pretty remote. So you're generally looking at just a couple, three holes in a piece of wood that may go several feet, and that's probably not enough structural weakening to make a difference in the most of the time what they're actually attacking are cosmetic members of wood rather than structural members. Usually they're getting into fascia boards and things of this nature, areas underneath the eave, things that are used, pieces of wood that are used not for structure but to actually fill in gaps so you don't have open holes.
Well, thank you.
All right. Again, other calls are welcome, 333-9455. That's the local number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we got somebody on the toll-free line, someone in Bismarck, and that's line four right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We have a wasp problem. The walk into our front door and then the lawn goes out from there. And every day from about 10 o'clock in the morning till about 3 afternoon, we have these low-flying black wasps that just circle and circle and circle for, at least 10 feet out from the walk.
Okay, probably about an inch and a half, 2 inches long?
About an inch long, and they're black. They have like an iridescent bluish wing.
Okay.
And they have a little bit of orange on their body.
Okay.
Stripe.
These are going to be solitary wasps of one sort or another. They may be a mud dauber wasp, which tends to have a little bit of orange, and these are very slender bodied wasps, right?
Right.
Yeah. There's also some that are called cricket hunters that don't have the orange, but they're bluish black, metallic looking. They're going to be finding insects of various sorts. Some will go after spiders, and they'll have a nest of the cricket hunters will have them down into the soil. They don't make a real obvious burrow. If you look close, you can find them, but they're very unlikely to sting. You essentially have to grab one barehanded to get stung by one of these insects. So generally we recommend a live and let live situation because they are helping get rid of crickets and things of that nature that we just as soon have fewer of. So what they do is they will have a burrow in the soil. They will find the insect. They'll sting it to paralyze it, take it underground, lay an egg on it. The egg hatches out and eats the paralyzed but still living insect. That's the way you keep fresh meat in the real world. And then the wasps will grow up to be full grown larvae and pupae and come out as adult wasps the next year. You can mow through there and everything else. They'll just try to get out of your way, and you're very unlikely to have. They can sting, but they're very unlikely to do so. So usually no control is normally needed.
Well, my husband is allergic to bee stings, and our guests that come up the walk are very afraid of this. So we've been using our back door a lot.
Uh-huh.
But you don't advise using any type of.
To do any control, you'd be looking at carbaryl soda 7 dust, and you'd have to locate the burrows. Oh. And on this particular wasp, that's almost impossible. I've searched for them before and had a very hard time finding them. So you're probably not going to be successful if you try.
They've been coming every year, and we are getting, we're just getting a little bit tired.
Well, there usually will be numerous. They're a native insect, and most native insects are numerous for about 3 years, and then they drop off in numbers as their parasites and predators knock them back, and then they'll be gone. They'll be less numerous for 7 or 8 years and then start to get numerous again. Usually they have about an 11-year cycle with 3 years being numerous and 7 or 8 where they're a lot less numerous. So, they're likely to be at towards the end of a cycle on that to where they should be. They're likely to reduce next year, although there's no guarantees. But I really don't know anything you can do to eliminate them. Even if you were successful in treating them this year, You've got an area where obviously they are attracted for one reason or another, and ones from surrounding areas that probably come back in there next year. So you'd be treating them on an annual basis, I'm sure. So,
well, maybe after 3 years they won't like us anymore.
Well, they'll probably be reduced and not be so numerous. But, you know, it's maybe I'm too close to insects. But but my way of looking at it is when you have guests and so on that get upset about it, it's a great teaching opportunity to teach them a little bit about nature and how not to be afraid of it all the time.
Very well, and thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Again, 333-9455 in Sheeran, Champaign, Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Phil Nixon's our guest. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I, and if you're having an insect problem around the house, you can give us a call. I think it's interesting that I'm sure we tend to think of wasps and bees both as social colony insects. Are there many varieties of wasp that are solitary?
Yeah, there's enough various types of bees and wasps that there have been theories developed as far as the evolution of sociality within the bees and wasps by looking at the various species that you can look at as being somewhere along the trail to being a totally social bee or wasp. And so you have a lot of a lot of them that are what we call solitary, and that means that you've got females that came out, probably they come out about this time of the year and will look for a protected area to spend the winter. Many of, particularly the bees, will be and will mate in this time of year, and the males die off. They nurture the sperm through the winter, feed it actually, keep it alive, and then we'll use that sperm the following spring to fertilize their eggs. And a single female will make a colony, and it may be down in the soil, and bees and wasps are similar this way, and then essentially just raise her own young. And in that situation, you can look at it from a human standpoint or anthropomorphize the situation by indicating that, you know, if you're an individual and you are the source of your children only, which we're used to being, you're ahead not to necessarily attack a giant, that is somebody of our size. You know, we're looking at, you got somebody that's 6 feet tall and there's something that's an inch long taking us on. That takes an awful lot of courage. If you get killed in that situation, which you almost certainly will, attacking something as large as one of us, then your line of children and so on, your progeny, will cease to exist. On the other hand, if you're a very social bee or wasp, such as honeybees or yellow jackets in the case of wasps, bumblebees are another bee that's very social. There you have a colony which has usually a single female queen that is producing the eggs. And most of the individuals in the colony are sterile females. They're capable of stinging, but they're not capable of reproduction. So there, your best chance for your line of genetics to survive is to make sure that queen and her larvae survive, because that's your hope for your genetic future. You have no genetic future because you're sterile. And so from that standpoint, if somebody happens to come into the area which you see as a threat, your best hope is to attack this giant, try to drive it off, sting it all you can, get all your sisters in there to sting it too, because you want them to stay away from a colony which has mom and the kids. But on the other hand, if you're a solitary bee or wasp, you're ahead to run, fly away, if something attacks your nest. Because it's a whole lot easier for you to produce more progeny by laying more eggs than it is to defend the ones that you've got and die in the process than if you've got to continue to feed those larvae. They'll die anyway, so the net result is you lost your genetic line.
Yeah.
So it's getting kind of theoretical there, but it actually works that way. The insects, the bees and wasps, that tend to be very social, they tend to be very aggressive when you get around your nest. And those that are solitary tend to be very non-aggressive. It's the better choice to run and leave. When you have a social bee or wasp, such as a honeybee or a yellow jacket, that's out foraging for food, Now you're in a whole different situation. Now you're in a situation where really the survival of the individual is more important than giving up their life for the colony, because their colony is not at risk. And so a bee or a wasp that happens to be sitting on a flower that's getting nectar and pollen is easily scared away and will be flicked away and so on, and will normally run rather fly away rather than flee rather than fight. But once you get next to a colony, then the stakes are higher for them to fight.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. When the caller first started in her comment, I guess I was thinking to myself, well, for sure this has got to be a cicada killer, because
yeah,
it seems like almost every time we do this, someone calls in and asks about cicada killers, which are wasps, and they're really big. And I could see people would find them sort of disconcerting if you get one of these things right in your face. Yeah. But this is another one of these solitary wasps. The males can't sting you, you know, no matter what you do.
That's correct.
As you have explained it, if they get up in your face, it's just they want to know, are you another male cicada killer? And
right.
As soon as they figured out that you're not,
they could care less about
they don't
you.
Care. They don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care what you are. And that as far as the females go that can sting, I think you said that pretty much you would pretty much have to grab one.
Right, exactly. They're a solitary wasp.
Yeah. Again,
so their
yeah.
best bet for their progeny is to run off. I mean, if they're in a situation just like these cricket hunters where they tunnel down into the soil, they're bringing down an insect that's paralyzed, they're going to lay an egg on it, and then they go do it all over again. And so they're much better off, if you come in and attack their nest, to fly away and go build a new nest somewhere else, because they've already provisioned a nest there. You're probably not going to get down 8 inches to it anyway. They have no reason to try to protect their young. They figure you won't be able to get to it anyway, or evolutionarily they figure that out. And so they're ahead in their for their promotion of their genes through the generations to flee, and so that's exactly what they do. They try to avoid confrontation, except the males will look you over to see if you're a male cicada killer and need to be run off, or you're a female cicada killer and I'm going to try to mate with you. You know, you're just part of a landscape. Forget about you.
That's
you know,
right. You could be a tree as
that's
far
right.
as they're concerned. Okay, well, we have somebody here with a question and others. We're about midway through here, plenty of time for other questions. If you have some kind of insect pest problem around the home, could be inside, could be out in the yard, our guest is Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I, and he'll tell you what to do about it. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone else in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question involves privet thrips.
Uh-huh.
I had at the beginning of an infestation last year, and it got worse this year on one side of my yard and my hedge. And I have treated it with Bayer 3-in-1 insect disease and mite control active ingredient imid.
Imidacloprid, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that seems to have been effective in that the new growth is no longer looking like it has thrips.
Right, it should
However,
work.
The thrips have now moved to the privet hedge on the other side of my house. And I have treated that as well.
Okay.
My question is, if the new growth looks okay, do I need to spray this an additional time on either side this year? And whether or not that's true, my second question is, what do I do about pruning the hedge for the rest of this year? I'm reluctant to cut off the new growth that looks healthy because I figure that's what's feeding the roots.
Okay. One thing nice about the thrips will... For those people who aren't realizing what we're talking about, a thrips is about an eighth inch long, very, very slender insect. And in privet, they're really cute because they're black and white banded. Most thrips are kind of dull brown or black and nothing to them. I mean, they're the cutest thrips there are. But at any rate, they will scrape away the surface of a leaf and suck up the juices. And you end up with a lot of brown streaking on leaves. And in a heavy infestation, a good share of the leaves are brown. If your situation is such that you have a lot of green still on the leaves, that green part of the leaves is still producing food for the plant, and trimming back to hedges would be fine as long as you've got a lot of greenery in that leaf tissue.
Okay. Some of the part that had the initial infection last year, I think if I prune off the new growth that shoots out, there won't be very much because
okay.
it was its second year.
Yeah.
So should I leave those shooting out parts? Or
yeah, you probably
I
should leave those or just prune them back partially so you still leave a lot of green foliage that's the new foliage. And now you sprayed with the insecticide, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, an option that you can do, you should be in fine shape for this year. You should have knocked back the infestation where it's not likely to be a problem. In coming, now that you know kind of what the thrips look like, if you do see them coming on next spring, a better application, a longer lasting one, would be to apply the same material sowed as Bayer Advanced Tree and Shrub Insect Control to the root system so that it's taken up by the roots. And it may take a month or two to get up through the plant, but it will be a situation where that type of application will last for a year.
Is that something you do in a preventive way, or do you wait and see if the infestation has returned and then do it?
I would say that it depends on the situation. If you've had the privet thrips on your privet hedges for a number of years, I would do it in a preventative situation as soon as it warms up next year to where the sap's flowing and the plants are probably using are going ahead and working and the leaves are functioning. I would go on ahead and apply it. If it's something that you just saw this last year or two, then I would probably wait to see if you're starting to see some damage.
Okay.
And then treat. So normally we don't recommend preventative treatments unless you've got a good standing reason why.
Okay.
Now, one caveat, and this is going to involve some work for you probably, is that imidacloprid ties up in dead organic matter. So you'll have to clean out underneath the hedges if you don't normally do that, out of sight, out of mind sort of thing, and apply that to bare soil to get good results.
Okay. So what was the name of the product?
Be sold as Bayer, same as your aspirin, same fat company, Advanced Tree and Shrub Insect Control.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, very good. On to some other callers here. And the next is in Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a curious problem. It's not a problem, actually. I have a post that holds up my porch roof that's made out of cedar, and it's got a 3/8 inch, pretty close to a 3/8 inch hole in it, and I noticed that about 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wasp-like, or it's about an inch long, that seems to live in there.
Okay.
Now, in right now it's stopped up. The hole is full of mud.
Okay.
And goop, and then about middle of June, all of a sudden the thing's open.
Okay.
And one time I sat and watched for hours, and it was after it was opened, the critter would crawl in there and fly out, circle around about 5 or 10 feet away, and probably drop something, and then you go right back in the hole. I just finally figured, what could it be doing other than cleaning out the hole?
Probably is.
So do you need a lot more to figure out what that is?
Is the insect slender or stocky looking?
More slender. It's not a carpenter.
Okay.
Bee. I
okay.
got someplace else.
Okay. And kind of a bluish-black insect or blackish insect?
It's blackish. And
okay.
One time I saw some little tiny versions of it, very small, you know, small as a fly, or crawling around, sniffing at the hole.
Okay. Chances are what you've got is, this sounds like maybe you've got perhaps a mud dauber. Usually they make their nests on the outside and do not utilize a hole that's there. You may have a more likely perhaps might be a spider wasp. Which tends to get fairly large. Some of them are they range from about an inch to 2 inches or more. And what that's doing is it's probably a spider wasp is more likely to be the scenario, and it's going to be as its name implies. It goes out and catches spiders, stings them, puts them in there, lays an egg on it. The larva hatches out, feeds on the living but paralyzed spiders. And will come out then as an adult wasp, which will look the same size. Chances are the smaller wasps that you were seeing around that, in my opinion, are most likely to be parasitoids we call them, of the spider wasp, and would attack the would get into the nest if the spider wasp is not real vigilant, and its young would then live on the larva of the either the larva of the spider wasp and kill it, or might live on the might be in what we call an inquiline, an insect that would get in there and actually would feed on the spiders and instead of the insect, the larva was intended to feed on them. Mm-hmm. So it can be a it's a jungle out there, and even in your backyard along with post on your house, it can be a jungle because you have things that are feeding on the spiders, which, of course, feed on insects and are looked at as generally beneficial. But we don't see this as a harmful insect necessarily. But then there are insects that feed on it, and, there's...
So the one, I think you've answered one question. It's not the same adult that I'm seeing.
The little ones would be something different, a different species, very likely something that takes advantage of the spider wasp and what she does in one way or another, either feeding on her prey or feeding on her young, one of the two.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. And let's talk again with somebody else in Champaign. This is line three. Hi.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some carpenter bees, and I had a fellow take care of them. But my question is, do I have to check that out quite often, or would one application of whatever you gave them get rid of them all?
One application would have taken care of what is probably was actually active at the time. There's probably nothing that's going to kill the larvae that have developed. That's why we recommend keeping the hole open until sometime in the wintertime or in the early spring, caulking it up to keep a new carpenter bees in it, and then painting the surface usually keeps them away.
And I have one other question. How do they cut those perfect holes?
They work in a circle. It's probably as good a reason as any.
That's what they did.
If you watch them, it's kind of interesting to watch them. They do have mandibles or jaws that are able, if you look at them under a microscope, they look like a cross-cut saw, okay? So there's a good reason why they could go through wood. And then the teeth on a cross-cut saw. And then they will, if you notice them, they will tend to open the hole by working in a circle. They will turn around and around and around. And, of course... That just almost by definition gives you a circular hole.
Yeah, when I first saw those, I thought someone had drilled a hole in the roof.
Yeah, they're so smooth and so perfect that they look like they've been drilled. And, of course, if you look at the carpenter bee and think of it, you're probably not going to hold one, but if you should look at one and think about what's the cross-section of that bee look like, it's essentially a circle. And it's been my experience that animals, whether you're looking at humans or other animals, work no harder than what they have to get the job done. So to make a hole that's any bigger than the circle that they fit into is waste of labor. And they don't do it.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Other questions, welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Got about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at U of I. This would be the time of the year when people are going to start to notice yellow jacket activity, particularly around dumpsters, places where there's food refuse. And this is a wasp. I think people don't really generally distinguish, anything like that. I think that people are more likely to think of bee, but this is a wasp, and it can get to be kind of a nuisance. But is it anything more than just a nuisance?
It can be more than a nuisance to various people. The yellow jackets of the workers are about a half an inch long and bright yellow and black. And many people think that they're bees, but like you said, they're actually wasps. And it's an easy thing to think that because if you look at the package of a jar of honey to Honey Nut Cheerios to various other things, you have a picture on that of really a yellow jacket, and it's called a bee. It's colored like a yellow jacket. Honeybees are really amber and black banded. They're not bright yellow and black, and they tend to be a little chunky looking and hairy, and they're not as photogenic as yellow jackets are. So it's an easy thing for people to get the wrong impression. And yellow jackets will hang around. They build up. They're quite beneficial generally through the season because being wasps, their larvae feed on meat. And generally with yellow jackets, that's caterpillars, of which most caterpillars we look at as being harmful unless they're eating weeds for us. Generally we look at them as being more helpful than good. But towards the end of the season, you end up getting very few larvae, and essentially the nest becomes nothing but a mass of reproductive and non-reproductive females and then also males, which are going to feed on sweet liquids. And so then they start getting very anxious as their numbers increase and the flowers start to cease to bloom in the fall. Not only have they now reproduced to where there's not enough flowers around if they were blooming in good shape, but the flowers are reducing and they become very, very anxious and very, very aggressive in trying to find sweet liquids of any type. And that means beer and pop and all sorts of things. And they search every crack and crevice looking for it, which means all over your body as well. And all you got to do is move a little bit, catch a leg, and they will sting immediately in response to that. They're very aggressive, very temperamental. And in fact, people that are susceptible to it, it can be a life-threatening situation. We have, I think I've seen numbers indicating that that somewhere around 45 people in the United States die every year from yellow jacket stings. So it is something that's a threat, probably many more than shark attacks.
Yeah, okay.
So, the thing that not only that, but and we avoid them around garbage cans and so on by keeping the lid on. They're going to need to have an opening to get in and out of. The other thing that's a problem is they will make their nests inside in the ground, and also inside the walls of houses. When they do it in the ground, we can drench the nest with through the opening with a bucket with mixed permethrin insecticide in it, and throw a shovel full of soil and run like the dickens. Do that in the evening when you can still see without a light. On wall nests, and whether you do something on that on in ground nests, you may be able to live with that. But wall nests are a problem because when they as the fall comes about, the ones inside will start dying, will get to where they can't go out and look for food. And then there won't be much anyway because there will always been already been a frost or two. Flowers are all dead. And they will seek the heat of the inside of a house. And they are capable of chewing through solid wood, just like carpenter bees can. And they'll eat a hole through two. They'll seek for warmth, and they'll come into your house. And I've talked to people who've had a couple hundred of these per day in their house for about a week coming in from outside, from nests inside the wall. So it's kind of important to get them killed this time of year while they're still using that outside nest. And this is done by using carbaryl or 7-dust put around the opening to the nest. Don't clog up the hole. If you're successful, again, they'll eat their own hole, and they're likely to go through the softest wall, which is the inside wall. And all of a sudden you have wasps in your house. But generally, the 7-dust around the opening will kill off the nest within 3 or 4 or 5 days. And then if there's been no activity for a couple of weeks, you can caulk it up or just wait until winter to caulk it up. There won't be another ones going in there. The nest that's inside is made of paper that they've made with air gaps in between. It makes tremendous insulation, so there's no need to open the wall and get the nest out.
Okay. I have a couple of other callers here. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the topic of grubs.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk a little bit about milky spore, what that is, and does it work?
Milky spore is a bacterial disease which has worked for decades, and we're having some problems with its effectiveness at this point and have had for several years. We don't know why exactly the case is. But it's essentially a bacterial disease that that attacks the hemolymph, the blood of the insect, and causes it with their reproduction and so on, that their blood, which is normally kind of clear looking, turns white, and so you end up with a grub that's chalky white looking in appearance, and even if you wound the insect, you'll get this white milky stuff that comes out. Hence the name. It's been applied for years. It was originally found attacking Japanese beetle grubs in a golf course in Ohio. It was marketed by an individual And it's still marketed today, but originally it would give you usually about 90-95% control of the Japanese beetle grubs and would last from year to year. So although it was expensive to put in, it was an excellent option. Unfortunately, in recent years, for probably about the last 8 or 10 years, we've been noticing that we're not getting that type of level of control, and we don't know if it's a processing of a material that you can buy that's at fault. Or perhaps, and my personal opinion is this latter option, is that the Japanese beetle grubs have develop some resistance to it. And we're finding now at usually the best 40% control, and at the worst somewhere around 10% control of Japanese beetle white grubs with this material. So we've ceased to recommend it to University of Illinois based on that situation because, you know, it was a great organic control for years, but it seems to have lost its effectiveness, and it appears like perhaps the grubs have adapted to it. Many times insects, if they go through about 30 or more generations, they will adapt resistance to just about anything, and this has been being used since the 50s.
Oh, okay. And I had another question with that, too. Does it affect earthworms if you put that down?
To my knowledge, it does not affect earthworms. In fact, it doesn't even affect ever grubs. So you can have the June beetle white grubs, and they won't be. You only kill like maybe 2 or 3% of those with the milky spore disease. But in the good old days in the 70s, it would knock out 90-95% of the Japanese beetle grubs.
Okay. So really, it's best to use like I know you gave the chemical. Before.
Unfortunately, we're down to chemical controls or maintenance of a lawn. If you allow your if you allow your lawn to go dormant and to be, as I like to say, drier and browner than your neighbors, then they will go to your neighbors and lay their eggs, and you won't have near the problem.
Okay. All
that
right.
would be in July.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Line number two is next. Caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have what's probably a very common question. How do I keep Indian meal moths out of my cupboards in the kitchen and basement?
Well, Indian meal moths, for those people who don't know what he's talking about, are about a quarter-inch long moths that are very slender, and they'll sit out in the open on your cupboards and walls and so on. And they have about a 3/8-inch wingspan. If you look at them close, they've got a two-tone wing. They're grayish at the base and then reddish-brown towards the back end. Their larvae, you get up to about a half-an-inch long, will be in any type of stored food product that's of vegetation in origin, grain products, fruits, dried nuts, chocolate, these sorts of things. And the protection of them is to store your product in airtight containers. This will be like Tupperware or glass jars. And material that you think could be infested can be frozen for 3 days, and that will kill any Indian meal moths in them, as long as they haven't had a chance to cool down and adapt to colder conditions, which at this time of year they would not have. But for those people that might find it in that come in from bird seed that they might have out in a garage or something a few months from now, cold temperatures will not kill those. They will have adapted to the cold temperatures. But generally, that's the sanitation is the control. We don't recommend any insecticide at all because if you can protect the foodstuffs from the insects, you will eliminate them. And freezing for 3 days will kill them. And then just store things in airtight containers.
I've thought that I had things airtight, and they still get through. They're pretty clever at that.
Well, they will lay their eggs there. If there's a little bit of a hole at all in that gasket, in that opening, they will lay the egg where they can smell the grain product coming out. And then the larva that hatches is about the size of size 50 sewing thread in diameter, and it will just crawl right up through into that little tiny hole and get in, which is why we don't recommend that you seal things in plastic bags, because most plastic bags have a little tiny holes at the seams. And then when the larva gets full grown, it has jaws that are strong enough to chew right through the plastic bag. But generally, I know what you're talking about. I just in my own house in the last week, I found cigarette beetles in a Tupperware canister of flour. So they will sometimes get in. My only thing that I can say sort of a Tupperware corporation is this is a canister that's about 25, 30 years old, so maybe it's lost a little bit of its spring and its airtightness.
I see that there's advertised for moth traps that have pheromone.
Yeah, the traps are primarily something that you can use to determine where the moths are located. I'm not certain that you're going to get really good control. Generally, what you're going to get is you're going to attract male moths to these traps, and you may not get the female moths. I'm not certain as to whether female moths are attracted as well.
Just said that there was male moths.
Pardon?
What I've seen just said that.
Yeah, it should say just male moths because they're using a female pheromone to attract the males to a trap. And so These are used a lot in commercial situations where you have a big warehouse and you're trying to find out where the infested product is. You know, let's say you've got some major food company or a middleman warehouse, and you've got Indian meal moths in it. You put these traps around, and where you find the most moths is probably the close to where the infested product is, and that's where their main use is. Some enterprising individuals have figured out a way to market that to people to use in their homes, and although it will help reduce the number of moths, I don't think it's going to eliminate infestation for you.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll try real quick to get one more in Sullivan, line 4. Go ahead.
Yeah, what can a person buy to use on Formosa termites? You know, ground application, put a barrier.
Formosa termite treatment is used. We use the same materials as we would recommend here. The main products are going to be imidacloprid, which will be sold under the brand name of Premise, P-R-E-M-I-S-E, or fipronil, which is sold under the brand name of Termidor, T-E-R-M-I-D-O-R. Those are the same insecticides we recommend for subterranean termites here. Formosan termites are a southern U.S. pest and so far haven't been found this far north.
I have a place down south. And
yeah, if you got one in New Orleans, that's Formosan termite heaven.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. And there we will finish up with our thanks to Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I. He joins us periodically. We do this show. If you have insect problems, you can always look in the phone book and find the nearest extension person to you. There are people all over the state that do that, and you can call them and ask these kind of questions. And if they can't tell you what the answer is, Phil is the guy that they call.
That's right.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.